This is a podcast from ABC Overnights. Here's Trevor Chappell.
Our guest this morning is Dr. Anne Rees, a historian from La Trobe University. Good morning, Anne.
Good morning.
Hey, Anne, I presume it's for various reasons that we see women go to America. We've found out about an awful lot of women who travel to England to continue their careers, but we don't hear so much about women going to America.
Yeah, that is true. And there's a few reasons for that. I mean, the most obvious one is that more Australians, including more Australian women, did travel to England. And the obvious reason for that was because, you know, Australia was founded as a British colony, and well into the 20th century, it was, you know, just kind of much more obvious and more straightforward to Australians to travel to the UK. They often had family there. But also there was just, you know, it was more straightforward in terms of getting the access to live and work in Britain. There weren't, you know, the same kind of visa constraints that existed in the US. So it was certainly the more popular destination, but my research has focused on this kind of significant and growing minority of women who travelled to the United States as well.
And what were the sort of reasons? Were there greater opportunities for women in America?
Yes, there were. So, I mean, on an individual level, like for each woman, there was often an individual trigger that sparked them to go to the United States. It might be that they wanted to complete, you know, a tertiary degree at American University, or they wanted to gain professional experience, or they just wanted to have an adventure. But the general kind of thread that links all the women I've looked at, and I've studied about over 700 women.
Wow.
Yeah, it's a lot. It's a sense that America was more modern than Australia and Britain throughout most of the 20th century. And a big part of that modernity was being more modern in terms of gender roles, in terms of having more opportunities for ambitious women to have careers, and in terms of being more accepting and more open to that. So women might have gone to the United States to complete a particular degree, but they very often stayed longer than they initially planned, because when they got there, they found it was such a progressive, such a kind of modern atmosphere. There's some wonderful kind of quotes I've uncovered with many Australian women commenting on this theme, and one woman even described the United States as a paradise for women, which is, you know, kind of overstating it quite a bit. But it does give a really strong sense of the way in which Australian women were so immediately struck by this. Just seemed, you know, a way, way less sexist, hostile atmosphere.
Do you know what's interesting? And I know this hasn't anything to do with the research that you're talking about, but at the same time, African-American women were leaving America and going to England because there were greater opportunities for them in England, especially in the music industry.
Exactly. I mean, I think it's, you know, really important to flag that this phenomenon that I'm talking about, you know, it's about white women. And it's often contingent on white privilege. So, you know, the Australia, the time period I've been looking at in the first half of the 20th century, you know, is, you know, around 98% kind of Australian British identified, so very white nation. The people who are traveling to the US are white. And the kind of, you know, the circles they're mixing with are white middle class urban women like them, whose ability to have careers are often because they might have African American domestic servants, for instance.
I'm fascinated to find out about Isabella Lethem in just a minute, because that's a fascinating story in itself. But Shelley first. Hello, Shelley.
I just want to say that there was a lady in our family, cousin once removed, twice removed, called Carla Hogeveen, that's Hogeveen, who became, I think in her early years, she was very, very attractive, and she became a model, and then she became an actress in Sydney. And we're talking about 60s, probably 60s, maybe 50s. And she was in a very popular TV series where it was situated in a secondary school. So she was a school student, and she would have been 17, 18, 19 probably. And she had very, very blonde hair. She was kind of a blonde bombshell.
Yep. Did she go to America, Shelley?
Yeah, she did. And she was very successful in Sydney. She, at kind of the height of her popularity in Australia, she decided, you know, that she would extend her acting career over there. And I think she also thought that people would take women actresses more seriously if they'd made it overseas. So she went to America.
Thank you. And when you take a look at that, because I would presume that's one of the areas that we would have seen in your period of research, that there would have been a lot of actresses that went to the States.
Certainly, many, many actresses. From the very beginning of the 20th century, there's actresses, and then when Hollywood takes off, you know, in that first decade of the 1910s, a lot of women go to California to try and, you know, have a crack at becoming a Hollywood star. Because, you know, as was just mentioned from the caller, that there was a big sense in Australia at that time that you were only successful as an actress or as a painter or as a musician or in most kind of creative fields if you'd made it overseas. It wasn't enough to be a big deal in Sydney. You had to go and be a big deal in London or New York or Los Angeles, and that proved you were really talented.
See, now Australian actors and actresses are really well respected and sought after in Hollywood. Were they at that time? Did they become successful?
They did. I think a lot of them who did aren't very well known today, but some of the very first kind of mega stars of Hollywood were actually Australian born. So one of them is a woman I've researched quite a bit called Sylvia Bremer, who did a lot of kind of, you know, stage acting in Sydney. And then she joined a local company called J.C. Williamson, which was a kind of local stage company that was founded by an American man and had a lot of American roots. And this was a really, this company was really important in kind of exposing local actresses to American, you know, theatre and film networks and kind of giving them, you know, the idea, the inspiration that maybe they could go and try their luck in the United States. So Sylvia Bremer went off to the US in 1916. And by 1918, she was being kind of discussed in all the kind of Hollywood fan magazines as the kind of, you know, the most successful new young lady of the year was one quote that was used to describe her. So she was, you know, a really, really big deal. And there were many others like her. There was Louise Lovely. There was Judith Anderson. There's a whole host of people who were the biggest stars of their day.
And did they highlight their Australianness?
Well, yes and no. I think it was often the journalists and the studios who highlighted their Australianness, because even quite early on in Hollywood's history, there's quite a sophisticated mechanism for kind of giving stars a certain kind of personal brand, we might call it. And Australianness often did become key to their personal brand. So they were often described as being natural or wholesome beauties who, you know, kind of got their good looks from just sort of, you know, being outside in the Australian sun and swimming and being very athletic rather than all the kind of makeup that American beauties were associated with wearing.
I love that.
I know, and there were often some pretty kind of farcical stories about, you know, their youth growing up, you know, in the great outdoors amongst kind of crocodiles and snakes and, you know, the kind of reportage we still see in America today associating Australia with wild animals.
Isn't it good that some things just don't change?
I know, definitely.
But they rode kangaroos, they used to pack koalas, they were all of those sorts of things.
Yeah, and they were often, Australian actresses were often seen as, you know, very good at physical stunts because of this, because of, you know, their extensive, you know, kangaroo riding experience.
I wonder if that was expected, that because they're Australian that they'd do their own stunts and the Hollywood stars that are American, that they wouldn't be doing that sort of business.
It was quite a blanket rule, but certainly they had a reputation for being very athletic.
I've got a text here that says, "Hi Trevor, my daughter has gone to the USA under a sports academic scholarship at a university. This has allowed her to continue cycling at an elite level and getting a university degree at the same time. There's no opportunity in Australia to be able to do this, which is really sad." Is that something that was also looked at that you found, Anne, that people went to America to extend or to bring forward their sporting careers?
Certainly, that professional sport was, you know, professionalised in Australia. I mean, sorry, in the United States a lot earlier than Australia. And there was also, crucially, just a lot more money going around in the United States for sports people, but also people in all sorts of industries. I mean, that's really another important motivating factor to stress, the money, that it wasn't just the US seemed more open to women, that there was it's a very wealthy, enormous nation with a lot of private money coming from private philanthropies, from the mass market, and that money seems open to women. And for professional sports women and men, that was certainly a lure. And one of the more interesting kind of sports women I've looked at is this wonderful surfer called Isabel Lethem, who became famous in the summer of 1914-15 as one of the very first Australians to surf and to really popularise the surfing sport, which didn't really exist in Australia at that time.
What took her there?
So she, it was a sort of a Hawaiian-American man who taught her to surf. He'd come over to Sydney that summer. So she was sort of exposed to the idea of the United States initially through him. And then she decided that she really loved the celebrity that she'd got in Sydney as being this kind of local surfing diva.
Can I just go back just a second, Anne? This is when the Duke came to Australia.
It is. So it's when Duke Kahanamoku,
yeah,
who was a Hawaiian Olympian swimming champion and a really famous surfer.
Yeah, and famously he taught her to surf in Australia. She was the first woman to. I didn't realise that she went back to America.
Yeah, so I just clarify, she wasn't the first woman to surf.
Okay.
There was another woman called Isma Amor had done it. There was a few surfboards kind of floating around Sydney by this time, but it was very fringe. People didn't really know about it. It was just a kind of really hardcore surfing people. So Isabel's remembered as the woman who kind of popularised surfing, yep, who helped make it mainstream. So then she went to the United States because she loved the celebrity she'd got in Sydney, and she thought that maybe she would try her luck in Hollywood, as people all around the world and lots of other Australian women like Sylvia Greener were doing. So in 1918, the World War I's still going on. She's only 19 years old. She gets on a boat all by herself without much of a plan and heads off to America. And now, like, you know, a lot of women then and still today who go and try and become famous in Hollywood, that didn't really work out for her. But she did actually have a really thriving career in the States in another industry. She became a really successful swimming teacher. And she first started working at the University of California, Berkeley, just outside San Francisco, where the kind of modern, what was being described as the modern pedagogy or science of swimming instruction was being taught, that, you know, really stressed the technical mastery of each stroke and things like that. And so she became one of San Francisco's leading swimming instructors. And she loved her life there so much that she took out US citizenship because she believed that there were better opportunities for women in the United States. But then her story has a bit of a sorry end because she was loving this Californian life, but then one day in 1929, after she'd sort of been there for about 10 years, she was walking home from work and she fell into a manhole and had a really serious back injury and then had to come home while she was recovering from the injury and then never kind of made it back to America because 1929 was the beginning of the Great Depression. Yeah. So suddenly, you know, it was hard for everyone to travel because there wasn't much money and her parents were ill in Sydney. And so she ended up spending most of her life back in Sydney as quite a well-known swimming teacher in Sydney's Northern Beaches and as a kind of, you know, local sort of pioneer of women surfing.
And in the States, did they have a better attitude to women in the workplace? Because in Australia, there was almost an attitude that if you got married, then don't even bother. And if you decided to work in certain careers, that they weren't necessarily the right ones for women.
Certainly. So one of the great contradictions of Australian history is that Australia was the first country in the world to give white women full voting rights and the right to stand for parliament. That happened in 1902, before any other country in the world. But Australia was also, despite this kind of giving women their political rights, was also internationally renowned for the sexism in its workplaces. And so that really stopped women being full kind of equal citizens. And one of the most notorious manifestations of this sexism in the workplace was the marriage bar that existed in the public service until 1966. So the marriage bar essentially meant that in any public service role, which could be, you know, working for a Commonwealth department or being a school teacher, which is, you know, part of working for the state, if you were married, you couldn't have that job. So if you were working in a job and then you got married, you were presumed to have quit, essentially. And one of the most shocking examples of this affecting a woman's career in the United States was in the case of one of Australia's first female diplomats, who was called Julia Moore, or her maiden name was Julia Drake Brockman. So she became, in the middle of World War II, when a lot of, you know, young men were fighting, Australia for the first time opened its diplomatic service up to women. And Julia was one of three women who were allowed in this kind of intake of cadets in 1943. And she was a really, you know, she's only 18 years old, but incredibly ambitious, incredibly smart, and she was determined to represent Australia overseas. And it took her a few years of kind of hanging out in Canberra, but eventually she got a posting to New York in 1946, and she was appointed to represent Australia at the UN. And this was an incredibly exciting and important role because the UN had just been founded.
How old was she at this time, Anne?
She was only 21.
Wow.
So she's so young. She hasn't even finished a university degree, but she, you know, she comes from quite a successful family. The Drake Brockmans, who are a very well-known Western Australian family. Mm. Her grandmother was one of Australia's first female doctors. So, you know, she comes from a family of high achievers. And she's, you know, pretty determined she's going to be one of these high achievers herself. So she's in New York working at the UN. And she actually attracts quite a lot of notice for her really eloquent speeches talking on behalf of women's rights at the UN. And just sort of being a general face of Australia. And her speeches are written up in local New York papers and so on like that. But the great contradiction is, at this same time as all this is going on, her career is taking off, she falls in love with and gets married to one of her co-workers, one of the other Australians working for the UN delegation. And, of course, because of this public service marriage bar, which is still in effect, she is presumed to have resigned from her role upon marriage.
So even though she's working in the States as a diplomat?
Yeah, and obviously doing a very good role, very good job. So she and her husband were aware of this issue, and they had got engaged, back in Canberra, and had deliberately kept their engagement secret until they were both in New York, because they thought maybe when we're both over in New York, it'll be harder for them to kind of enforce this marriage bar. But still, the Public Service Board back in Canberra was determined to enforce it. And Julia, she conducted a bit of a battle against the Public Service Board, asking essentially to be exempt from this rule. And she, you know, looked to her male superiors for support, but they were not, you know, they were not particularly supportive at all. So she sort of went back and forth over a long period of time because, you know, the Public Service Board, they wanted her to lose her job, lose her diplomatic privileges, lose her good salary, but still kind of keep working for them, essentially, still doing labour while her husband was still in New York. So she is, understandably, was not very impressed by this proposition. So it was a really grueling battle. And what essentially ended up happening was that she and her husband got worn down. The effort of fighting with the Public Service Board, the effort of trying to do their really demanding jobs in New York just kind of got too much. And they just essentially decided to come back to Australia because it was just all too difficult. So they were only in New York for about a year or so, having these dual diplomatic careers, and then they went back to Australia. And her husband, John, became a very distinguished lawyer. And Julia, essentially, she ended her diplomatic career while she was still in her early 20s before it had even begun.
What a shame.
She had several children, and she worked a little bit as a social worker. But she'd clearly been a very, very promising diplomat, and that went nowhere. And the same thing happened to the two other women who'd been appointed in the same year as her. That by the late 1940s, they'd all married and they'd all been forced to resign.
You didn't even have to be married. So once you said you're engaged, that was enough.
Well, no, it was on marriage, but okay. Because this couple got engaged in Canberra, right. They thought if that was public, that Julia would be told, well, there's no point even sending to New York if you're about to get married. You stay in Canberra or only go to New York as a wife. And then there were no more female diplomats, essentially, throughout the 1950s. There was only three cadets in there that whole time, and it wasn't until 1974 that we had our first female ambassador.
Whoever said there's such a thing as a boys' club? Michael, good morning.
Mine's more of a general inquiry. I was Lismore, bought a travel clock dated 1939. On the back was a large inscription saying, Mrs. F. Gaze, presented to Mrs. F. Gaze by the executive officers and buyers of Marcus Clark and Co. Gaze, as in Andrew Gaze, basketballer, same spelling, of Marcus Clark and Co. Limited, Sydney, on her eve of her departure for America in the 39.
So she was obviously a person that worked for the company, that she was considered to be important to the company, and she was off to America.
Yeah, obviously, just before the war. And it's a travel clock about the size of a wallet that you'd put in your pocket. It's leather, of course, pretty tattered on the outside. I've had it repaired. Works fine.
Good. Now, I don't know if we know who Miss Gaze is, Anne, but did we see a lot of women in private enterprise? We were talking about public service, but in private enterprise going across to continue their careers?
There were some women who went off kind of representing Australian companies, because there was also a sense, as I referred to earlier, that America was so modern that it was an excellent place to kind of, if you worked in a private company, to get a sense of the latest trends in fashion, in design, in makeup. There was, at one point, the Australian Women's Weekly sent their kind of makeup editor over to the United States to study the latest trends, so she would be able to kind of advise Australian women what was going on that front. And, some Australian women went off to join American businesses because they felt like they could get more senior executive roles in the United States than they could in Australia. So it also extends to private industry as well.
We're talking this morning about the history of women working in the USA, Australian women working in the USA, with Dr. Anne Reese, historian from La Trobe University. And let's take a look at, well, firstly, did it add to our relationship with the US? Because especially really the Second World War is when we started to see a very close relationship with the States. But did this assist the relationship with the States?
It certainly did. I mean, as you've mentioned, our kind of dominant understanding of our relationship with the US is that it really kicked off in World War II. There's that famous phrase when our Prime Minister at the time, John Curtin, said, you know, Australia was turning to America. And then, of course, you know, we had the military alliance in the Pacific and all the American troops here and so on. And that was, you know, undoubtedly a really important moment in Australian-US relations. But what my research has made clear is that very close ties between the two countries long predated World War II, and that these Australian career women were really an important part of it. Because what happened was that they so often came back to Australia, and that was for a variety of reasons, but often it was because of the sense that, you know, as the youngest daughter in a family or as a single daughter, they had family obligations. They had to come back and care for their elderly parents, or their money had run out or things like that. But that For all these factors, they came back. And that meant that they very, very often imported ideas from the United States that they had learned while they were there. So across all different industries, across librarianship to modern art and design, there are really clear examples of women who'd spent time in the US saying, I practiced this modern, exciting technique when I was over there. I'm going to bring it back to my profession in Australia and bring Australian professional practice and teaching more in line with the States, which is a really quite radical thing to do at the time.
Yeah, but was that respected when those women did bring back that expertise?
No, and that's the interesting thing. I mean, it was often extremely controversial for a few reasons. I mean, because the default was kind of following British methods. It was sort of still well into the 20th century. It was often, in many fields, the unstated assumption that, you know, everything British was the best way to go. So sort of saying American methods might be better was quite controversial. And secondly, it was controversial because these were women, you know, trying to come back and assert themselves in professions at a time when, you know, a lot of them were still very sexist and male-dominated. So one woman I've looked at, for instance, was a really interesting modern artist called Mary Cecil Allen, who spent most of her career in the States. But she came back on several occasions in the mid-30s, in the 50s, and again in the 60s to lecture to Melburnians, where she was from, about the really exciting innovations happening in American art. So she was one of the first Australians to talk about Jackson Pollock, you know, his dot paintings, which is now seen as, you know, one of the most important artistic innovations of the 20th century. She was sort of talking about it before anyone else. But she got incredibly hostile reactions from the Melbourne artistic establishment because it was seen that she was this sort of uppity woman from overseas talking about a kind of art that was seen as degenerate and primitive and not real serious highbrow art. So she was just kind of publicly ridiculed in the mainstream press, and that was not at all unusual. There were many women who had experiences like that.
Kathy, good morning.
Good morning, Trevor and Anne. Anne, I wonder if you're familiar with Jessie Street.
I am familiar with Jessie Street.
She was on the UN. She was, I think, first woman on the United Nations.
Yeah, so Jessie Street was, you know, the very well-known Australian feminist who worked in many organisations over the years. And she was a hugely important Australian woman in campaigning for women's rights at the UN. She worked with Julian Moore, that pioneering diplomat I spoke about earlier, at the UN in the late 1940s. And she also represented Australia at the conference in San Francisco to found the UN. So, yeah, she was a really notable woman feminist representing Australia on the global stage in the States.
Yes, and here she was also very involved with Aboriginal rights as well.
Yeah, she was. She was involved in many different fields. And there were quite a number of feminists who went to the US. Another one is Linda Littlejohn, who was the president of the Australian Federation of Women Voters. She did a lot of lecturing in the United States. And she, like many Australian feminists of that era, had a sort of really interesting take on gender relations between the two countries. These were often feminists who'd grown up in Australia, believing that Australia was the best place in the world to be a woman because Australia had given white women the vote and full political enfranchisement before anyone else. But Linda Littlejohn and many other feminists, when they went over to the States, that view really shifted, and they thought, you know, actually Australian women and Australian feminists in particular have so much to learn from America. Women are so much more emancipated here.
1-300-800-222 is the number to call if you'd like to join us. Just talking about that idea of sexism, tell us about Jill Kerr Conway.
So Jill Kerr Conway was an Australian woman historian who went to the United States in the early 60s to complete her PhD in history at Harvard. And And she became very, she only died last year, and she became very famous later in life for her series of memoirs about growing up in Australia and moving to the US. So many people might have heard of The Road from Corain, or The Road that was published in 1989, and then her subsequent one, memoir True North. And in those memoirs, Jill Kerr-Conway makes it very, very clear that to be a woman in Australia in the late 50s and early 60s, especially to be an intellectual woman, was a very, very challenging experience. She writes in vivid detail about the sexism she experienced in Sydney, and just how relieved she was to escape and go to Harvard, where, although, you know, it obviously was not a pure woman's paradise, it was still a very male-dominated world, she felt like she could be respected as both a woman and an intellectual. So she eventually ended up having an incredibly successful career as a historian, but also as a leader. So in 1975, she became the very first woman appointed the president of Smith College, which is an incredibly elite women's college in Massachusetts. You know, ironically, even though it's been a women's college since its foundation in the 19th century, it took until 1975 to have a woman president. But she was the first woman in America to have that kind of role, and became a really, really important leader known nationwide.
And you know what I think is really fascinating of the research that's been done is that there was an Australian judge in the States before there was an Australian judge in Australia.
Exactly. We often think that Roma Mitchell is Australia's first woman judge, who she was appointed to the Supreme Court of South Australia in 1965. And she was certainly the first woman to sit on an Australian bench. But I've come across this fascinating woman called May Lay, who was born in Queensland. And she went over to, as a young woman, to study law in California in the 1910s. And she actually ended up being appointed a judge in California in 1928. So, you know, around four decades before Roma Mitchell became a judge in South Australia. So, you know, in one sense, I think we can say she was the first Australian-born woman to become a judge anywhere in the world.
And did she go to, was there a reason she went to the States to study law?
Well, it's a bit kind of shrouded in mystery, her initial reason for going. The family legend that accompanies it was that she was known as kind of being a pretty feisty young woman with the gift of the gab, and an uncle of hers who was living in California at the time said that, you know, why don't you come over here and, you know, study law? You'd be a great kind of advocate in the courtroom because you're so good at talking. So, you know, we don't know if that's kind of fact or rumour. But that's the kind of story that went around. And certainly her law experience makes it pretty clear that, you know, even though on the one hand there's only 2% of women in the law profession in America at that time, and May Lay, you know, talks really vividly about not being paid as highly in the early years of her career and, you know, finding it really, really hard just to live as a lawyer, that's still, you know, a far sight better than her home state of Queensland, which didn't even have its first woman lawyer until 1926.
It's a great story, as all of these stories are. It's been really good talking to you this morning, Anne.
My pleasure.
Dr. Anne Rees, who's a historian at La Trobe University, taking a look at just some of the women who travelled to the United States to not only continue their careers, but to start their careers in so many different fields.